gripped. Many people were displaced from their homes in the north and in El Shajaya. We're not targeted as journalists individually, but they bombed our whole building, bringing it down with 3 missiles. It means the occupation is trying to silence media, audio and images. It's a crime. They want to kill the journalists in one hit. There were 36 journalists inside the building at the time. They targeted the building with no prior warning so that we had no chance to evacuate the building beforehand.
It's natural for journalists to be frightened, cautious, and not want to stay long in places that clearly are a potential target of Israeli missiles. Many evacuated from their news desks and resorted to working out of hotels in their continued efforts to write and prevent their words and video footage from being silenced by the invading Israeli forces.
I come from Khan Yunis city. I had to move to Gaza because of the very harsh security situation. As a journalist, I come to stay in a hotel where I am sure I can provide the needed life and coverage services to the to Press TV. I was injured in one in the morning. I was attending my work. I was doing this work in an area that is known to be full of journalists from the different media outlets, including some foreign journalists who are doing some live coverage and media coverage in general for some international and regional media channels. This is the area where I was targeted and injured. And where I sustained my injuries, I tried my best to stay awake. I tried my best also to establish what was happening, but it was far beyond my capacity because of the very strong explosion and because of the surprise and because of the injury.
Palestinian journalists continued to deliver audio and video reports during the war that so displeased the Israeli government and military, it issued a statement which Palestinian journalists interpreted as a preface to direct targeting.
What happened is that Israel, prior to targeting the first journalist in the Gaza Strip, Hamid Shahab, through their media office, issued a public statement ordering foreign journalists who had entered the Gaza Strip to go to the beach hotel for sanctuary. We issued an immediate statement telling Palestinian journalists that it meant they were being targeted as long as they were not included in the statement. That was our perception of this.
On the eve of July 9, 2014, the first Israeli aerial bombardment took place in what is considered the high-class neighborhood of Al-Rimal in Gaza City. The target of the raid was an automobile carrying a sign that read press on it and driven by journalist Hamid Shahab with co-worker Hatim Selmi at his side. They had stopped by Hatim's home to briefly check on his family, whom he had not seen in a while. Shahab remained in the car outside. A minute or two later, while Hatim was with his family, a missile hit their home, and Hamid Shahab lost his partner.
I was at the office working for the fourth day in a row without going home. I went then, returned home, had a bath, and changed my clothes. I saw my family, but decided not to see my mother as I knew she would become too emotional. You know how mothers get after their sons are away for a while. Hamid phoned me to say he was coming to my home. I went to the balcony to watch for him, but he said he couldn't see me. He told me he was entering the street, and I was looking down both sides to find him. He entered from the Kazim area, from the opposite lane, because he was coming from Al-Sabra neighborhood. So he said he is now in the street, and I told him I saw him and ended the call. I was going downstairs. My mother was there, and she commented that she had not seen me in a while and that she missed me. I was touched and moved back to kiss her hands and head, and I was about to hold my brother's hand when there was a huge explosion.
It was Ramadan, and we were leaving the mosque after Taraweeh prayers. We sat with my cousins and a few uncles next to a press vehicle.
وقفتان عندك وين وراك؟
Another car parked behind us to pick up Hatim Selmi, a journalist who was upstairs. The driver's mobile rang, and the next thing I was aware of, we all woke up at the hospital.
I held one victim in my arms, but he was lifeless. I moved to the next, and they too were dead. Then another and another. I wanted to work my way through those that died so that I may find someone alive to rescue. The injured I could help. The driver was nowhere to be found. The car was unrecognizable. The explosion was so severe. I searched for the driver, but found nothing until a first aid officer found his legs and half of his abdomen. The car suffered a direct hit. It was indeed the target. I imagined myself sitting next to him when the explosion occurred, cut to ribbons, dying together as martyrs.
As the war on Gaza continued, the targeting of journalists, too, continued and escalated. Israeli occupational forces assassinated 6 journalists, all in 1 month, prompting many other journalists to go into hiding.
I would often warn him, but he always insisted on venturing out to film and record the truth for the world to see. It was in his blood, and he worked passionately day and night. The only time you knew he was alive was when he would call and tell us he is in a certain place and safe.
He would film the martyrs and help carry the injured on his searching to find them all. He used to come home asking about me and my day. He hid his blood-stained clothes from me because he knows I have high blood pressure and diabetes. He didn't want me to feel upset.
Rami was very courageous. Whenever I saw him putting on his helmet and vest, I would ask, "Where are you going?" He would say he was going to do his job and show the truth to the world. I reminded him that we have young children that need their father, but he always said, "What's meant to happen will happen. We can't lock him in a room."
Rami Ryan did not respond to calls from his parents and wife to stay home and not cover the war and go out in search of crimes being committed by the Israeli aggressors. Rami is a photographer and an only son. He is married with 4 children, and his job supports them all, the whole family. Rami's family, like other families of journalists, worried incessantly every time a bombing or massacre occurred. It was a traumatic time for all.
I had my child Rami after 14 years of marriage. I spoiled and doted upon him as he was my only son. He married after high school and had 2 girls and 2 boys. I always scolded him, saying he is an only son and all would be lost if someone were to knock on my door and tell me something happened to him. May he rest in peace. He never listened to me. His work was a message he had to deliver, even if the price was his blood. He was prepared to die for the cause.
I phoned him in his last days. He was away so much, and I told him that he needs to come home and spend time with his children, as they missed him so. He promised to come home early that night, and he did come, and we ate dinner together. He showed us some of what he had filmed, horrible scenes from his trips accompanying the PRCS as they evacuated displaced people from Ash-Shajaiya.
The last time I saw him, I was in afternoon prayer and he was about to leave. I raised my voice saying, "Allahu Akbar," to make him wait. Then he came to the window side and waited. Once I finished my prayers, I told him that his kids are still young and that because of the risk he was taking, that one day he would die in the blink of an eye. He told me that Allah will look after them and told me that if I locked him in a box, he would die. So it's better that he lives as he was meant to. I told him that he exhausted me with worry, but that he's also right in what he said.
One day, Rami journeyed out to cover a massacre in Al-Shajaiya neighborhood. His photos taken at the site were the last images he ever took. Scores of rockets and missiles rained down on the same area after the initial massacre, and Rami was martyred.
the incident of injuring and killing and murdering Rami Rayyan in Ash-Shaja'iyya neighborhood when the Israeli occupation forces targeted the market, killing with the deceased Rami more than 17 people from Ash-Shaja'iyya neighborhood. That was another evidence that our job is full of risks and that our life is at the stake, but that also that surprised us, but that also made us determined that we are the guards of the truth.
Rami's family lost their son, husband, father, and sole breadwinner. The only consolation for the family members is that Rami died exposing the truth, embedded in the photographs he took of the massacres and other crimes committed against the Palestinian people.
May he rest in peace. He has been martyred, which is a privilege. Praise the Lord that he was chosen. He was a kind-hearted and a good man. There is nothing worse, though, than when a child asks you, where is her father? You might answer that he's in paradise, but then the child says, when it rains, Dad will get wet, and so he should come here to stay warm with us. You answer that it won't rain on him, as the Lord protects him in paradise, where he has everything.
The war in Gaza lasted for 51 days. By the end, dozens of journalists had been killed or injured. Witnesses to Israel's great loss over its battle to monopolize and control media exposure, which severely damaged its reputation on the world stage. Witnesses to the success of Palestinian resistance in the face of one of the largest and most technologically advanced armies in the world today.
Here there are 7 martyrs and about 30 wounded. Of the wounded, some have permanent disabilities. In every war by Israeli aggression, there's a great sacrifice from the Palestinian media sector, and I can tell you that we have no problem in giving our souls freely to expose the hellish barbarism of the Zionist regime.
We have lost in this war 18 brothers from the family of the press in Gaza. If journalists didn't put their lives on the line to expose Israel's crimes, if they did not succeed in this mission to be the messengers of the occupied peoples, then they would have not been targeted by the Israeli army. I think the Palestinian press succeeded in their endeavors that shows their love for their homeland.
There was a distant challenge this time in that the Palestinian media became a serious counterweapon versus the Western-dominated Israeli media and narrative. We were able to refute their narrative of lies and manipulation of the truth this time. They overrode our signal, but we broadcasted from other stations. When Al-Shaab radio station was targeted, the Al-Quds station was saying, here is Al-Shaab voice from the studios of Al-Quds station. When Watan and Al-Aqsa stations were targeted, we said we were their voice. We made it clear if they targeted one studio that the whole Gaza radio network would all be the voice for Al-Quds or Al-Shaab or any other Palestinian station attacked. We think we succeeded in this battle to make the truth in war prevail and to successfully counter many of the lies broadcasted as Israeli propaganda.
Even if a war erupted right now, we will still continue our work. For instance, I'm from the neighborhood of Beit Hanun, where almost every family has been displaced. My family stayed initially in a collective center. Our house was targeted, and thirdly, my place of work at Al-Watania Media was taken out by a missile. It took me just 4 hours to get back to my duties. Every journalist is subject to risks, just as the families and the thousands of children displaced. I didn't see my family for 52 days. Even when injured, I kept on working. Palestinian journalists are fierce workers in their dedication to expose the occupation in all its aspects.
Almost immediately after the war came to an end, media personnel returned to their offices to work, and staff of the destroyed networks found new premises to set up in and continue their brave cause.
As soon as the radio station was bombed by an Israeli airstrike, we were back in the saddle coming up with ways to get back on air reporting events. Even with the loss of the archive and the old premises of Al-Shaab, we started working and thinking of how to revive our efforts despite the sustained risks. Nothing will stop us from our path to serve the Palestinian cause.
Al-Aqsa radio station represented the resistance media, a voice that will never run out of means to continue. We have infinite alternatives and options that the enemy is not even aware of. Our signals will never be permanently ended. With Allah's will, we will return to the airwaves, always, one time more than we are knocked down.
They may have killed or deported journalists, but their pictures are immortal witnesses to all the horrendous atrocities committed by the Israeli occupation on Palestinian soil.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Imam Khomeini suggests that several practical remedies for curing anger. According to Imam Khomeini, among the practical remedies, the important ones involve withholding of the self in the initial stage of anger. Imam explains the matter through his theological works as following. There are also several practical and theoretical remedies for curing anger when it has flared up.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience, you're listening to another episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we try to read some of the speeches and sentences of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi about different subjects and context. We do that in the hope to come to a deeper understanding of this great character. In one of his sentences about Islam and our deeds, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi holds that, take lessons from the awliya of God, who have been always after the school or maktab, and not after their own selves. Well, this speech of our great Imam has got an important message. While recently many Muslims are following the corrupted idea of carpe diem, which says whatever you like, you can do it with no attention to its consequences. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi here is giving us the lesson that when we accept Islam and become Muslims, then we must follow Islam's ideology or maktab in every detail of our routine life. It isn't in this way that we can follow the rules of our sharia whenever we like or whenever it is in the line with our benefits. No, that's a big mistake. When we accept this religion, you should stand against yourself when it encourages you to follow your whims and commit sins. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is aptly referring to this fact that a Muslim should be so strong in beliefs that not even for a moment he or she might lose control over his or herself. You know, according to what Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, such a control was found within the souls of awliya of God who were so careful about their self-control. This sentence of Imam rahmatullah alayhi is just in line with a lot of verses and narrations about the importance of controlling nafs al-ammara, or the part of the self that encourages you to do evil and commit sin. Imam Ali alayhi salam said in that regard, أَشْجَعُ النَّاسِ مَنْ غَلَبَ هَوَاهِ. The bravest of you people is he or she who controls his or her whims. You can see that gaining such control is so difficult that Imam Ali alayhi salam perceives such person as the bravest. We must learn to be faithful to our maktab and sharia and know that for sure Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows us better and wants our good.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll try to have a look at the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode. Now, please, let's listen to 187, 188, 190, and 191st verses of this very chapter.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فَأَسْقِطْ عَلَيْنَا كِسَفًا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ إِن كُنْتَ مِنَ الصَّادِقِينَ.
So cause to fall upon us fragments of the sky, if you should be of the truthful.
قَالَ رَبِّي أَعْلَمُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ.
He said, My Lord is most knowing of what you do.
فَكَذَّبُوهُ فَأَخَذَهُمْ عَذَابُ يَوْمِ الظُّلَّةِ إِنَّهُ كَانَ عَذَابَ يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ.
And they denied him, so the punishment of the day of the black cloud seized them. Indeed, it was the punishment of a terrible day.
إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَآيَةً وَمَا كَانَ أَكْثَرُهُم مُؤْمِنِينَ.
Indeed, in that is a sign, but most of them were not to be believers.
وَإِنَّ رَبَّكَ لَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الرَّحِيمُ.
And indeed, your Lord, He is the exalted in might, the merciful.
فَأَسْقِطْ عَلَيْنَا كِسَفًا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ إِن كُنْتَ مِنَ الصَّادِقِينَ. Therefore, cause a piece of the sky to fall on us, if you are of the truthful.
قَالَ رَبِّي أَعْلَمُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ.
He said, My Lord knows best what you do.
فَكَذَّبُوهُ فَأَخَذَهُمْ عَذَابُ يَوْمِ الظُّلَّةِ.
They belied him. Then there seized them the chastisement of the day of shadow.
إِنَّهُ كَانَ عَذَابَ يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ.
Verily it was a chastisement of a grievous day. Now, dear listeners, as you were previously with us, the story of invitation of Prophet Shu'aib started when he introduced himself as, I am a trustworthy messenger, إِنِّي لَكُمْ رَسُولٌ أَمِينٌ. You have to be in awe of Allah, you have to obey me, and you have to obey me because I am not asking you any recompense for it. Now, his main reason to criticize the people was that the people of Shu'aib, Ashabul Ayka, were a group of people who were cheaters. They used to defraud people, and he ordered them, وَزِنُوا بِالْقِسْطَاسِ الْمُسْتَقِيمِ. And at the end, he commanded them, وَاتَّقُوا الَّذِي خَلَقَكُمْ وَالْجِبِلَّةَ الْأَوَّلِينَ. You have to be in awe of him who has created you. You have to fear him. The one who has created you is the very one who has created the generations before you and the generations to come after you. But these people did not listen. They, in response, said, إِنَّمَا أَنْتَ مِنَ الْمُسَحَّرِينَ وَمَا أَنْتَ إِلَّا بَشَرٌ مِثْلُنَا. They said, You are only of those bewitched. They used to justify their actions, and you are nothing. You are just like a mortal like us. Why do we have to listen to you? But in response, they said, فَكَذَّبُوهُ فَأَخَذَهُمْ عَذَابُ يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ. They denied him, and as a result, the chastisement of the day of shadow overcome them. Now, what did they ask for?
فَأَسْقِطْ عَلَيْنَا كِسَفًا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ إِن كُنْتَ مِنَ الصَّادِقِينَ.
Cause a piece of the sky to fall on us if you are only of the truthful. And in response, he said,
قَالَ رَبِّي أَعْلَمُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ.
My Lord knows best what you do. We will discuss these verses after a short break.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن
القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So what they mainly wanted is that they asked him to send the chastisement by which he threatened them so that he could understand that they are not afraid of these threats. But the only answer Prophet Shu'aib عَلَى نَبِيِّنَا وَآلِهِ وَعَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ gave them for those inconvenient statements about their indecency and those, of course, bad words and indecent words that they asked for divine punishment was this. قَالَ رَبِّي أَعْلَمُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ. He, Shu'aib, said, my Lord knows best what you do. Now, what Prophet Shu'aib implicitly says is that Allah knows best of what you deserve. Whenever He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, finds that you deserve for a chastisement, He may send it down over to you. And at last, the time of wiping the earth from these polluted ones came. And the Holy Quran says, فَكَذَّبُوهُ, they belied Him, فَأَخَذَهُمْ عَذَابُ يَوْمِ الظُّلَّةِ. As a result, there seized them the chastisement of the Day of Shadow. Now, as the tradition suggests, for 7 days, a blazing heat overtook their land, and there existed no wind at all. Suddenly a piece of cloud appeared in the sky, and there blew a breeze. They hastily came out from their own houses, and since they were uncomfortable because of heat, they went under the shadow of the cloud. And at this time, a fatal thunderbolt was created by the cloud. It was a thunderbolt accompanied with a very loud sound that followed by a falling fire over them. And simultaneously, an earthquake shook the earth when all of them were annihilated. We will continue our discussions of these verses in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Aperture.
The
In the modern era, man has reached ever new technological heights unprecedented in history. We can now communicate and interact with those halfway around the world with ease, manage workloads with a click of a finger, or access information and news in a matter of seconds. Perhaps a world without electronic technology would be unimaginable. But this miraculous blessing has a very, very dark and toxic underbelly. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. The electronic technology we are so dependent on creates waste unseen in the Earth's history. Every year, up to 50 million tons of electronic waste, computers, television sets, mobile phones, and household appliances are thrown away by consumers in the developed countries. 75% of this waste disappears from the legal recycling circuit, much of it dumped illegally in the third world. Stay with us as this week's documentary spans the world to reveal how greed and corruption are ruining the globe's legal recycling systems, damaging the environment, creating security risks, and endangering human health.
We produce up to 50 million tons of e-waste every single year, and our discarded appliances increasingly end up in places like the dump site in Africa. We first came here 3 years ago, while risking serious health problems such as cancer and brain damage. Since then, the situation has worsened dramatically. The amount of e-waste coming into Africa has almost doubled. And also in Europe, South America, and Asia, the discarded symbols of our modern lifestyle are corroding landscapes and poisoning the soil, water, and air.
It's a crime. I mean, this is a crime of mammoth proportions.
E-waste trafficking is huge and said to be bigger than the drugs trade. Even though the export of e-waste has been banned for more than 30 years, thousands of e-waste containers cross the oceans every year. And the toxic tide is set to rise even further because, in spite of the crisis, the sale of electronics is booming and emerging markets are coming on board. All contribute to a growing mountain of e-waste to which we can no longer turn a blind eye.
It's like a doctor looking at a patient who's bleeding profusely and saying, "Oh, it's not so bad." When I hear people like that, I say, just go. Just take a plane and go look for yourself and tell me that's not a problem.
All over the world, law enforcement, environmental activists, customs officials, and undercover investigators are fighting to stop the traffickers.
Para ese tipo de personas, el futuro no cuenta. Lo que cuenta es el beneficio inmediato.
The battle is difficult to win because of the huge profits to be made and the corruption involved.
C'est tout un système de montage avec des sociétés écrans. Là, on peut parler de système mafieux.
Can we stop the toxic tide before it is too late? Mike Anane is a Ghanaian environmental journalist and activist. He has made it his personal mission to stop the influx of e-waste to his country. He has discovered that many of the computers dumped here still bear the names of their original owners in Europe and the US.
I'm looking for the asset tags or the property tags. Yes, it gives a lot of indication and provide a clue as to who owned it, who used it.
Mike told me that he had a plan. He wanted to take his collection of tags on a journey of investigation.
The idea is to take these things back to the previous owners, the original owners. And these are e-waste that belong to people in the UK. I'll ask them questions as to how these things got to Ghana, if they have any idea. Somebody has to pay for these things because the environmental and health consequences are enormous. They are killing people here. They should be responsible.
Mike is taking several pieces of e-waste to the UK. The first one originally belonged to Leeds City Council.
Dear Mr. Councillor, my name is Mike Anane. I would like to come and see you to show you what I found and to investigate how your discarded computer equipment found its way to Ghana. This is the moment that I have been waiting for, to listen to their side of the story.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Please do meet you. Capital David Blackburn. If you want to come this way with me.
Okay. I collect the asset tax of some of the e-waste that gets dumped in Ghana.
Royal College of Nursing, yes. HMS Customs at Thames Valley.
South Bank University.
South Bank University, that's in London. So you've got a fair spread of England, you know.
Let me show you the place where I found this equipment.
This is where I keep the e-waste. They have asset tags or property tags. You know, when you look at this, for instance, it says Leeds City Council. It should have been disposed of in that city of Leeds.
Terrible, huh? Terrible. Yeah, not acceptable at all. Is this the same all over Africa? Or is there specific parts of Africa where we're having problems with it?
We have Nigeria and, of course, Ghana.
Mm.
Yeah, these two countries are the major countries that receive electronic waste.
We've researched as far as we can that particular piece of waste from the serial number they can date it. But, I mean, we're talking 20 years ago. And, as I say, at that time, I mean, the ethical, what was thought to be ethical was, we'll recondition them and give them to charities that can't afford their own computers. But I don't think anybody actually thought the thing through, that what happens when it is no longer in use.
The records of the donations no longer exist, so Councillor Blackburn can't tell Mike which computer went to which charity. The trail has gone cold. Mike tries to trace back more of the tags he has found in Ghana.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Anani. I'm trying to reach 212 regarding some recycling issues. You happy? Is anybody around?
Yeah, at the moment, it's basically 2-2 has gone into administration. We've been taken over by Daisy.
Mm-hmm.
All recyclers involved were closed down or sold on years ago.
This number is for sale. For information, call Odin.
After a whole week in the UK trying to trace back the tags, Mike still doesn't know who sent the e-waste to Ghana.
I'm very much disappointed. I have been to several places and the usual excuses, it's been 20 years or we give them to charity. And I find these excuses rather funny. Yeah, because it doesn't take away the problems, it doesn't take away their complicity, and it doesn't take away the fact that they are to be blamed.
Uncovering the e-waste traffic is not as simple as Mike had expected, but he is determined to continue his investigation. E-waste trafficking has been illegal since 1989, when the Basel Convention was signed, the first international treaty banning the trafficking of any kind of toxic waste. To date, 190 countries have signed it, amongst them China and Ghana. The European Union, too, has written the Basel Convention into its laws, prohibiting the export of e-waste. In other words, all EU waste should be recycled in Europe. A system has been designed. In Europe, when a consumer buys a new appliance, the purchase price includes a recycling levy. For instance, the price of a fridge includes a levy of up to 20 euros. Around 4 billion euros are collected this way in Europe every year. This money is used by the industry to run a system which collects, sorts, transports, and recycles our appliances. That's why we can hand them back for recycling for free when we discard them. Thousands of highly specialized recycling plants have been set up all over Europe. Here, the e-waste is treated without harming the workers or the environment. Professional recyclers can get a whole range of valuable materials out of our discarded appliances. But recyclers all over Europe are complaining that their plants are not running to full capacity. And the European Union estimates that at least two-thirds of European e-waste never make it to an official recycling plant. Spain is one of the worst affected countries. So what's going wrong? Belén Ramos works for OQ, Spain's biggest consumer association. She wants to find out why Spanish e-waste is not getting to the recycling plants through an experiment. Belen and her team are installing satellite trackers inside discarded appliances that could have come from any of our homes. In total, 16 pieces have been fitted with trackers. The plan is to hand them in for recycling all over the country and see if they find their way to a recycling plant or not. Soon, all the pieces of e-waste with the hidden trackers inside are distributed all over the country. All of them are sending regular satellite signals. This morning, there is news from the city of Granada, where a computer with a tracker was handed in for recycling. The satellite picture shows clearly that the new location of the computer is an abandoned lot and not a recycling plant. In a country with 26% unemployment and paltry benefits, some have turned to e-waste theft to survive. Security cameras and metal gates failed to deter the thieves. Fences are simply cut to provide access 24 hours. The copper cone inside a TV set can be sold to a scrap dealer for €2. A fridge will yield up to €10 and a system unit €4. But theft from collection points is not the only way e-waste is disappearing. In 2011, the Spanish Environmental Police discovered that 500,000 fridges had been siphoned off the official system and dumped. The case became known as Operation Fragmento, Spain's first high-profile e-waste case. A large criminal network, which included staff at collection points, recycling plants, and transport firms, had taken the recycling levy and then illegally scrapped the fridges. Their profit, €10 million. The case is currently pending trial. The final balance of Belen's tracker experiment, only 4 of the 16 pieces made it to authorized recycling plants. All others were scrapped illegally. That's 75%. But none of Belen's trackers have appeared outside of Spain. So how does European e-waste end up in the third world? An answer can be found in France. Here, in March 2010, the gendarmerie discovered a huge warehouse full of e-waste tucked away in a small town. Captain Doblemont was in charge of the investigation. So where did all this e-waste come from, and where was it going? D3E Recyclage had collected electronics for recycling from all over the region. Clients included public institutions, hospitals and prisons, and even the gendarmerie itself. The e-waste came flooding in for one reason. Under French law, companies have to pay for their old equipment to be recycled. But D3E offered an irresistible deal. Free recycling of monitors, which would normally have cost around €5 each to recycle. Nobody thought this was a deal too good to be true, because the paperwork provided by D3E Recyclage looked totally convincing. They even listed individual serial numbers, claiming that everything had been recycled according to the law. For several years, D3E operated calmly under the radar. Not a single inspection took place, which would have revealed that they didn't have any recycling equipment whatsoever. D3E may have only been a small company, but they were part of an international e-waste trafficking ring covering 3 continents. When Captain Doblemont discovered that the waste had left France for Belgium, he contacted Interpol for help. A huge international network began to reveal itself. The French monitors are being sold for between 50 cents and 2 euros a piece to a company in Belgium called Mobo. The investigators traced the head office of Mobo to Luxembourg. A truly international network was uncovered. Mobo and Luxembourg bought e-waste not only from France, but also from Croatia and the UK. They used a Romanian company for packing and logistics. The e-waste was exported from Holland to Hong Kong, Vietnam, and the Arab Emirates. The shareholders are based in the US, in Delaware, a notorious fiscal paradise. The French e-waste suppliers have been sentenced and their fake recycling companies shut down. But Mobo continue to trade, advertising their services on sites such as Alibaba.com, where e-waste from all around the world is traded freely and without borders. Thousands of e-waste containers leave Europe every year. This not only causes environmental damage, it also affects the economy. This was a major reason why, in 2008, the European institutions in Brussels started work on a new, more stringent version of the EU e-waste directive.
10% of all the gold in the world goes to electronics, and most of it then disappears. And the same with silver, with copper.
Every year, Europe dumps millions of tons of e-waste, including the valuable resources inside.
I think everybody needs to wake up to the fact that in 20 or 30 years, the world is going to have a huge resource crisis. And Europe in particular is very vulnerable. We import 6 times more than we export.
Europe currently spends 130 billion euros a year on importing strategic metals, even though some of this demand could be covered with recycled e-waste instead. This refinery in Belgium extracts copper, tin, silver and gold from old electronics and processes them for resale. 50,000 mobile phones yield 1 kilogram of gold and 10 kilograms of silver, worth about 40,000 euros. Currently, only 1% of mobile phones are recycled in Europe. This means that we're actually sitting on a veritable mine of precious metals and valuable rare earths. In January 2012, the European Parliament passed the new e-waste directive. The new goal is to increase e-waste recycling in Europe by making it easier for consumers to hand back their waste and by keeping the waste in Europe through stricter export controls at the harbours. But how easy is it to stop an e-waste container from leaving? Mike Anane has travelled to Scotland to meet the Environmental Protection Agency.
Historically, it's been West Africa, primarily Nigeria, but over the last few years, we have noticed an increase to Ghana.
What are the usual tricks that these illegal exporters use?
For example, changing the container drop-off point to the last minute, so as we can't be there to check, or potentially having material in the first few rows of the container that are work in order, but some material sitting behind that that's not work in order.
Only functional second-hand equipment can legally be exported from Europe. Everything else is seized.
So do you test every single equipment for functionality?
Not every single equipment. The amount of exports that takes place and the resource, it wouldn't be cost-effective. We have to use the resources effectively.
The team use a video camera to look inside the container and to see if any of the contents look like e-waste.
You were checking a 40-footer container, but the camera was not long enough to get to the end of the container.
It's another indication. That's why the majority of our effort goes into the use of intelligence and the use of inspections at an earlier stage. We've already had information from that exporter to show that each of the fridges had been tested, but that was a spot check to ensure that the paperwork they'd given us matched up.
Mike is not impressed. The Scottish authorities, making the best of their resources, rely on information from the exporters themselves to stop any illegal shipments. The container was released for export soon after.
For me, I would say that the controls that I saw at the port in Scotland was not good enough. Every single item would have to be checked for functionality, particularly of the contents. If it's refrigerators, if it's television sets or computers, they would have to find out whether they are working in good working order before they're shipped or whether they're just junk.
In spite of all European laws, Europe's harbours are clearly overwhelmed by the sheer number of e-waste containers being exported. But what about a country that produces more e-waste than anyone else on the planet and hasn't banned its export? The US produces a staggering 9.5 million tons of e-waste a year. A lot of this is collected by recyclers, for instance, at so-called recycling rallies, where people are invited to donate their discarded electronics to charity.
I'm not getting fired!
What most people don't know is that a lot of US e-waste is headed straight for the third world.
If you were to go out on the street and ask people, what do you think happens when you take your old computer to a recycler, they'll just say it gets recycled. Very few know that most of these so-called recyclers in the United States don't recycle, they just export.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very interesting question. This is a question related to the Quranic sciences. As you know, a lot of people are mentioned in the Holy Quran. One of the individuals whose name is alluded to in the Holy Quran is a person named Dhul-Kifl. This is a person who has been mentioned in the Holy Quran. And the question we want to ask today is this. Is this person a prophet? Who was this person? You know, what are his virtues? You know, is he a person like Luqman, who wasn't a prophet, was a wise person, a believer in God? Or no, was he actually a prophet? In the Holy Quran we read, and Ismail, Idris, and Dhul-Kifl, each of them was amongst the patient. So he's been characterized as being one of the patient, one of the Sabirin. We admitted them into our mercy. Indeed, they were among the righteous. They were the Salihin. But was he a prophet? Fortunately, this question has been answered. Imam Jawad alayhi salam was once asked by Abdul Azim al-Hassani, Abdul Azim al-Hassani, very famous companion of the Imams alayhi salam. He was asked about Dhul-Kifl by this person and his name and whether he was a messenger. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam said, Allah exalted be his remembrance, sent 124,000 prophets, of whom 313 were messengers, and Dhul-Kifl was one of them. Peace of Allah be upon them all. So indeed, Dhul-Kifl was one of the messengers, one of the mursaleen. One of the Rusul. He was, where, when was he? When was his era? When was his time? He was after Suleiman, Imam al-Jawad says, son of David. And he used to judge between people like David did before him. Hazrat Dawood, the prophet David, he was a judge and he used to judge justly amongst the people. This person named Dhul-Kifl, he also did the same. Imam Jawad alayhi salam said, he never became angry other than for Allah. So apparently his name was not Dhul-Kifl. This was his designation or his title. What was his name? The Imam says. And his name was Uwaydiyah. Uwaydiyah. He is the one Allah Mighty and Exalted, has mentioned in his book, saying, "Remember Ishmael, Elisha, and Zulkifl, each of whom was among the elect, the Akhyar." Probably the reference to the fact that he was elected or selected by God, you know, for prophethood. So indeed this person was a prophet, and one of his characters. So apparently, because he used to judge between people, we can gather that, you know, he had control over, you know,